Thank you, Robert. In last week's concert, we had the great pleasure of hearing cellist Lynn Harrell in Strauss's Don Quixote. And today it is our pleasure to talk with Mr. Harrell about his career, past, present, and future. Mr. Harrell has been principal cellist of the Cleveland Orchestra since 1965, a post he assumed at the ripe age of 21 at George Sell's invitation. Now, since his junior high school days, he has been appearing as soloist with major orchestras and winning a variety of prestigious prizes. I'd like to talk for a few minutes about a subject of great importance to young performers of talent, a subject in which I think you might be very helpful. My question is this: how does one survive early success and acclaim and come out of these stresses as a genuine artist without conceit and self-adulation? How is that done?
Well, Klaus, that is an excellent question. I feel that in the training of a musician, the utmost ideal of the greatness of the music and of the task and the responsibility at hand, that is to present the work of art in a meaningful way to audiences of today, but at the same time with as much authenticity as the composer would have liked. I feel that that is such a great responsibility and such a difficult job that if one always has that as their ideal and goal, I don't think it's possible to ever sit back and pat oneself on the shoulder and just relax. And if that is instilled within teaching as the fun of it all in music making, that is the constant searching, the constant relearning, and the constant realizing that one was wrong before, I don't think that that should be a problem. But of course, there are many young people that when they start having a career and get a lot of success, there is a certain amount of glamour that is very enticing and can be very dangerous to their development as musicians. This is a life not of personal or egotistical rewards. They're more of artistic and of serving other people and composers, people that are going to the concerts and the people that wrote the music that perhaps are even dead now.
I think everybody likes to be successful, and the artist, I think, has a certain need to be praised for a good performance. But there is this hang up about knowing better than the one who wrote about the concert how it really went. And is this sort of a self-protective mechanism, isn't it?
Yes, each artist, each person has a little bit of that, and one must. It was certainly part of the composer's intention that the music had to be played with personal conviction. I, as an artist, am not Beethoven, but on the other hand, I have to play a piece of music in the style and within the bounds of the composer's intentions. But it has to be my own at the same time. It isn't possible to just make it a very dry presentation that doesn't have any personal conviction. It's like going into a museum and opening the manuscript to a great work of art and just dusting it off and looking at it. That is only half the story. It has to be presented alive and vibrant today, and that takes the people that are playing it.
Well, you recognize then ever since your early days that there is a certain conflict between ambition and one's own sense of fallibility, if you will, that whatever the reaction of others, you have to develop your own sense of growth and development and your own self-criticism as something more important than what other people say. Is that?
Well, that again is, of course, something that can become a crisis a number of times during an artistic person's career. One always has to take one's own impulse and thought processes as honestly as possible. But on the other hand, one can't be objective all the time, 100%. It's just not possible. And that's when one has to listen to other people. Sometimes what other people have to say has nothing to do with what you think the composer's intentions are. But on the other hand, it might click off something in your mind that leads to something that you realize you are doing wrong, or that you realize that they have a point there about something. And this has to constantly be played back and forth, and how much to listen and to other people when, and all that is very complicated.
The real artist, like the real composer, draws from others what he himself needs or can use.
That's right, yes.
That, I think, is sort of an axiom in the field. In relation to this, who would you say have been the major influences on your own musical life since you were a child? I could think of quite a few. I'm sure.
Well, you probably could think of more than I. That's because you were able to. I was a child for a long period of time, so it's difficult to know during that period what influenced me. I don't remember my father ever singing at home, but I know and I feel when I listen to his records, and I approach a phrase that it has, that I have some influence rubbed off there. He being a famous baritone at the Metropolitan Opera for a number of years. The greatest influence in my conscious musical life since I was 17 or 18 was George Sell. Coming here and after beginning of a development of a solo career, more interested in learning the orchestral repertoire, in working with a great conductor and a great musician as Mr. Sell was, and learning to coordinate my musical ideas with a large ensemble was very challenging to me, and I think that influence was the greatest that I would be able to.
Now your teachers, of course, in addition to your father who taught you this marvelous innate musicality that we loved so in his singing, and also your mother who was a violinist, your teachers, Leonard Rose and Orlando Cole, must have certainly
I certainly cannot talk about this without mentioning my cello teachers. I learned so much from my lessons with Leonard Rose at the Meadowmount School of Music during the summer and Juilliard at Curtis in the winters. Also Orlando Cole, he showed me a completely different type of physical approach to music that I wasn't aware of up until that time. And also Lev Aronson was really the beginning of my conscious musical life. I don't think I would have become a musician if it hadn't been for Lev Aronson, who
that was in Dallas.
Yes, he was principal cellist of the Dallas Symphony for a number of years.
Also, I think you were very close to Robert Shaw in the younger days. Now that is an important influence, I would say.
Yes, it definitely was. When I would go to a performance of the St. Matthew Passion, this was before I was in the orchestra, or any of Robert's performances here in Cleveland with the chorus, like the Mozart Requiem, I remember, and the Missa Solemnis, they had a particular type of drama and excitement that was incredibly gripping, but at the same time was not superficial musically, and that was a remarkable thing, and I remember being very deeply moved and affected by
it. I also think that Robert Shaw's sense of the vocal line may have exerted some influence on your own phrasing.
Oh, yes.
His music always sang.
That's right.
And I think that's important to an instrumentalist too, isn't it?
It's very important. My personal conviction is that the string instruments, it isn't a coincidence that they developed principally in Italy, which is the seat of the greatest and the most natural vocal technique.
In the little time left to us, Mr. Harrell, I should remind our listeners that you have been a teacher and artist in residence and soloist at many festivals, including Meadowbrook, Aspen, Marlborough, San Juan, and Stratford. Now we learn that after this summer you will be leaving the Cleveland Orchestra, devote yourself to a solo career and teaching. And for some years now you have already been a faculty member of the Cleveland Institute of Music. I understand that your responsibilities there will increase in the fall. Will you tell us a little about that?
Yes. Well, Jim Levine will be musical director of the University Circle Orchestra, which is administered through the Case Western Reserve University and the Cleveland Institute of Music. I'm assistant conductor of that and string coordinator of the string sections of the orchestra. I play in the orchestra and assist the training of the orchestral pieces that we do in the program. In addition to that, I will be teaching cello privately for the first time at the Institute, which I'm very much looking forward to, and also more chamber music groups.
That sounds great. Will you tell us a little about your solo appearance plans for the fall, or are they top secret?
No, not at all.
Nothing's top secret anymore.
No, not at all. I'm giving a recital at the Institute with James Levine in October.
You did one in New York at Alice Tully Hall.
That's right.
It was a great success.
Yes. And then Herbert Barrett, my manager, has arranged a number of concerts outside of the city. I'm playing two chamber music concerts at the Library of Congress, one with Phyllis Curtin and one with Eugene List and Carol Glenn and Walter Trumpler and Gary Carr, the Trout and Hummel quintets. There's an appearance I have in Atlanta of the Brahms Double with Jamie Laredo, an appearance in Sarasota, Florida with the orchestra there, also in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and an appearance with Lewis Lane and the Akron Symphony and the Brahms Double again with Vincent Fratelli, his concertmaster, and Shlomo. And I have one other chamber music concert of trios of Ravel and Tchaikovsky with Jamie Buswell up in Lansing, Michigan in the fall, so it's going to be a very busy season.
It certainly sounds like that. Well, you're in the middle of a great career, and for the next 50 years or so, we expect to be hearing about you.
50 years, I hope so.
It's been a great pleasure to have as our guest Lynn Harrell, principal cellist of the Cleveland Orchestra and soloist in last week's performance of Strauss's Don Quixote. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Klaus.
Now back to Robert Conrad.